Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.
Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we have got a summertime lineup. Dining, gardening, cocktails, beer. It is tough to beat that. So we'll be talking with veteran restaurateurs Peter George and Tom Main about their new restaurant, Tinker Street. It's been 30 years since Peter George opened Peter's in Fountain Square, and we'll hear about what's changed in the restaurant business and why he's having more fun than ever. We'll check in with Master Gardener Joellen Meyer Sharp about a couple of problems that just might be affecting your tomatoes and basil. Then we'll head to Fletcher Place and talk with Repeal Restaurant Bar Manager Eli Sanchez, who's become known for his shrubs. And we mean cocktails, not gardening this time. And we'll wrap up with a sneak peek at a new craft brewery, Sanctuary Brewing Company, and this one has a very cool animal welfare component. So stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Veteran restaurateurs Peter George and Tom Main opened Tinker Street 5 months ago. They were jumping back into a business they had been out of for years. Tom at Puccini's and Peter at, well, Peter's, the highly regarded fine dining restaurant he opened in Fountain Square in 1985. But a lot has changed in the restaurant business in 30 years, and I wanted to know how Tom and Peter have been navigating today's restaurant scene and what the response has been to Tinker Street. A little neighborhood restaurant located at the corner of 16th and New Jersey Streets in Indianapolis. I sat down recently with Peter and Tom in the restaurant's popular patio to find out. You're approaching 6 months at Tinker Street, and it seems to me, looking from the outside in, seems to have been wildly successful, and that your fans have found you and have embraced it. So what do you think? Is that accurate?
I think it's been a really wonderful combination of the neighborhood really embracing us, old customers of Peter's, old friends of both of ours, and then we've also been blessed with lots of, you know, wonderful press, which has brought people in from all over the place.
And it's become a big, you know, a big draw for the neighbors, right?
Huge, huge neighborhood draw. We had no idea that the neighborhood would be this behind us. And we didn't realize what the demographics were. We just knew there were some beautiful homes on some beautiful streets, and we hoped people would come, but we had no idea the age group and the number of people and how many times they will just keep coming back to see us. It's been pretty remarkable.
We get people coming 3 and 4 times a week, which is, you know, incredible. And then we get people coming in for their anniversary and their birthdays, and we get it both ways, and we like it.
You have really been embraced then by the community.
It's incredible. I mean, we have like champions for our restaurant, you know, out there. We really do.
What has it been like for you guys personally, you know, back in the business after a significant gap in time? Is it what you envisioned?
For myself, it's everything I envisioned and better yet than that. On every level, working with the lovely young people we have both back of the house and inside of the house has been, I don't know what else, heartwarming. I don't know what else to say.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
I don't know. I've never worked with a better staff ever.
Now, and that's saying something, because your staff at Peter's was very highly regarded, probably the highest regarded team in the city.
Yep.
You know, it's difficult to put into words, but, you know, there was a couple in the other night. It was actually, we had a problem at the table. Okay, they were so incredibly complimentary of the server, because, oh, he was so informative, and, you know, he made this one little mistake. And then at the end, they said, you know, we've been to 15 or 16 countries, and this is a couple in their, I'm going to say, mid to late 30s, and never in our lives have we seen teamwork like this in a restaurant. And so yeah, those kind of things. He just, it sort of blows your mind. I mean, really. And something else I want to say is that, for me, working with Peter has been really great. No, it really has. It's been, you know, knowing that you have a business partner who is really strong where you are weak is awesome. And that's just got your back like that is just really, it's an honor and a privilege, and I mean that.
You know, you, Peter, have a reputation for being a tough guy to work for, very high expectations. Are you just as tough as you were back in the day? Have you mellowed a little bit? Have you changed?
Again, what he said, what I don't do well, he does. And so he brings kind of that those soft skills, and really it's rubbed off on me. So I'm a bit softer, but my expectations are still every bit as high. They haven't changed.
That's what I was speaking to before. It's just really been a good, just a great partnership.
How do you create that team? You know, people probably ask you over and over back in the day, back in the 80s and 90s, about creating a strong service team. Is it the same now? Is it different?
I tell you, it hasn't changed that much. I thought it was going to, and we actually discussed this going in, and we thought, well, we're going to have to, you know, do this, do that. And honestly, it's kind of just gone back to what I know and how I've always done it, and it's just, it's kind of that expect this, work to this bar, this high level, and keep working and working and working and talking and reminding, chastising if need be, if you want to call it that, but it's the constant just, hey, we can do better. I know we can. You did it better last night. Let's do it again tonight, that kind of thing. We don't leave it up for chance, I guess is the thing. We don't. We know what we want them to do and how we want them to do it.
Spend an awful lot of time talking about that energy, the energy that the guests feel, the energy that when they go, wow, we've never seen teamwork like this. You know, that energy is only possible if they come to work with it, for starters,
yeah,
right? With the desire that you really want to take care of people, because that's what people are feeling. But when we don't, we hear about it, because nowadays there's this much time between when you mess up and when you get to read about it.
One of the biggest changes in the last, you know, certainly the last 5 years, the last decade, is the instant feedback.
I think it allows people the opportunity to speak up even when they might not normally do so.
That's probably right. They might not be the person who throws a fit in a restaurant, but they might throw a fit online, right?
Right, right.
And why we spend so much time talking to our servers about just absolutely doing the best job they can to catch things. You know, when somebody says, hey, oh, it was fine, or, you know, and you just go,
fine. Oh.
Because, I mean, it's just going fine. No, I know how,
fine's,
you know.
Not good.
Yeah. So fine's not good enough, right?
No, fine's not good.
No, fine is not fine.
We hear fine and we're running to the table.
Is there something to do?
First of all, it's, you know, like the Colonel Clink, you know, it's your interrogation, you know. We have to interrogate. You've got to do a Q&A with that guest and find out exactly, pinpoint whatever it is. Try to make it better. If you can't make it better, there's no charge. It's just as simple as that.
But what if it was their fault? They ordered the wrong thing. They don't like fish.
Guess
and
what?
They ordered it.
Guess what? I had a guy order a hamburger that had blue cheese on it. He read it. He saw it. He knew it had blue cheese. Ordered it anyway. Came out with blue cheese. He didn't want blue cheese. He doesn't like blue cheese.
So why does he order it with something
because
that clearly says
he
that?
He has no clue why he did it. He just did it. He apologized up and down. We brought him a new hamburger, but we didn't charge him for it. So we made two of them. But the thing is, who knows what's in somebody's mind when they're out for dinner? Maybe they're mesmerized by the person that's sitting across the table from them. Maybe they're just not even thinking. We don't know what it is. I mean, we've seen it a number of times. People talk about coming in here and the vibe that we have. And I'm telling you, I don't care if you're 23 or if you're 80. They feel it. They're happy. It makes them feel good.
But so many restaurants these days seem to be, it's the chef's way or the highway. You know, no
Ooh.
Substitutions, no nothing. This is how I'm serving it, and you're going to like it like that.
You know? A little bit that way to a degree.
You know, we're not Burger King. I mean, right, where you go, well, I want to change all these things on the menu. But if you don't like something, it just doesn't matter the reason to us. I mean, it's not, who are we to tell you what you should like or not like?
And here's one of the things that I think that we've tried to address in a little different fashion. for instance, right now we have sirloin with some creamed collard greens and a cherry Cabernet Gastrique. Let's just say that you didn't know if you'd like that sauce. Here's what I would suggest. Let us bring it out. See what you think. If you don't like it, I'll do whatever you want me to do. I'll not charge you for it. I'll bring you another one with no sauce. I'll bring you something else. However you want to have it happen. But we have a lot of confidence in our chef team, in our culinary team, that you're going to like it. And if you're not happy, I'll have another one out for you in 2 minutes. You know, it's okay.
Are diners different today than they were 20 years ago?
Oh, yeah. In a good way.
Really?
Oh yeah.
So they're better. Better diners.
Oh, God. Yes. So much better. They're younger. They're more adventurous. They're eating healthier. Oh, gosh, they're so much fun.
We've been talking with restaurateurs Peter George and Tom Main of Tinker Street. We'll be back with more from Peter and Tom here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. When you're talking about favorite restaurants, the appeal is about more than just the food. A big part of what makes a place a favorite is the atmosphere, the ambiance, the vibe. Whatever you call it, it's important. And the vibe is certainly a part of the draw at Tinker Street, which opened in January at the corner of 16th and New Jersey Streets in Indianapolis. Tinker Street's owners, veteran restaurateurs Peter George and Tom Main, are back in the business after a considerable absence. Peter closed his businesses, Peter's, a restaurant and wine bar, Chops, an American Steakhouse, and Bistro 936 more than 10 years ago, and Main has been out of Puccini's for half a dozen years, but the two seem to have hit the sweet spot with Tinker Street and are having fun doing it.
Are diners different today than they were 20 years ago?
Oh, yeah, in a good way.
How do you cultivate that feeling? Was it something that you were trying for?
Part of it is, okay, so it's what our staff brings to it, right? Yes. The energy and goodwill. But, you know, generally, people are out to have a good time and are pretty darn good-natured, you know? And so they're having a good time.
Tell me a little bit about how the vibe or the feeling or the atmosphere is different from Peter's back in the day.
I think a lot of it has to do with just the energy, and also our price point.
Oh, no, that's right.
I think that how we offer it, what we offer, and the way it's presented from start to finish, right? Because you can't make a reservation, so you're already a little off guard, right?
So you're taking a chance that you can get in.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, and you're not on the offensive as a guest, right? I'm not entitled to a reservation. I'm not entitled to a time. So you're a little bit, you've kind of let the air out of the sail a little bit once you walk in. Hey, I'm leaving myself in their hands. I'm going to let them do the best they can, and we're going to hang out, and we're going to make it happen. We're going to have fun.
What was your average turn time at Peter's back in the day?
2 hours, maybe 2:15.
So, you know, we're right at 90 minutes.
But don't forget, since our turn time is an hour and a half, they may spend 30 minutes here or 45. And so it's still about the same amount of turn time. But the price point is so much different.
Okay. Yeah, how does that affect people's attitudes?
I think in an ultra-positive manner. They get a check and I've had people go, this can't be right.
In a good way.
Yeah. In a good way, right?
This cannot be right. And I go, well, let me take a look at it. I look at it and go, no, that's right. How could it be $76 for three people? We had five courses of food and four glasses of wine. How can that be? I go, well, because we can. Because that's what it is, you know, and it's great.
So the price point is different. Yep. from you know, the fine dining back in the day. But the service isn't different, and service can really make or break a place, right?
The service is a little bit more casual, though. Because
How so?
Well, for instance, you know, quote-unquote, we will auction off food at the table. It's okay.
So that's when someone says, and who had the steak, right?
Exactly. Yes, because we're not worried about that. We're really not worried about that. As a matter of fact, it's what we want to have happen. Because people
Why?
Are used to that today. And it makes it more approachable for our expo people and other servers to be able to help out. So the whole team can pitch in. Tom and I can help take food out. We don't know where it goes, but just tell me what I need to do and I'll do it. And they're happy with it. They're fine.
Maybe our expectations different these days?
Totally. When you don't take reservations, your expectations for being entitled to this or being entitled to a timeline or a specific table or this or that completely, absolutely fall off the edge of the cliff. They're gone. And I think that's what, I really think that's part of why it works.
So people are okay with that, and you're working with that to, I don't know, sort of build, you know, to build an atmosphere that fits that, right?
Oh, yeah. It's the culture that we want.
Is there anything negative about how dining has changed, you know, in the last, 20 years?
When you were saying young, what's great is now you have this wide range, right? Before, it had to be more well-heeled people, right, that were coming out. Now, everybody's coming out. And they've been educated more and more. They know way more about food than they used to, which is just, yeah, it is. It's really cool. So I think that makes the interaction more interesting because they have questions that might not have been asked years before.
I heard one of my favorite ones last night, okay? And, you know, Tom and I have been friends for 30 years now. And he knows my stand with respect to certain products and so forth. I had two young women. She's been in, I'm going to say, 6 or 8 times. Her friend's only been here a couple of times. They sat down, and we were talking about sirloin. And Carol said, you know, I think it's one of the most underutilized pieces of red meat in the marketplace. And I go, you're exactly right. And so we just continued the conversation. She goes, yeah. She goes, you know, you'll go someplace, they won't even offer it. Like if you go to a steakhouse. I go, I know. They don't want you to have something. They don't want you to have that product. It's reasonable. They don't want it to be that reasonable. They want it to be more costly so that, you know. And she goes, yeah. And by the way, it's got flavor and it's got texture. And you can do a whole bunch of things with it. She goes, I love it. I said, case closed. Enjoy the sirloin.
You know, so you have a more adventuresome clientele, bigger range of ages, a more food-centric clientele, maybe better educated or more well-traveled. So it's a combination.
Yeah, all of the above. And yet we still have plenty of people. They want some familiar things, just nuanced as well.
That's right. So you still have people who do want to recognize every part of it, right?
Or at least most of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we still sell, you know, I mean, and serve and prepare and make a lot of people happy with, you know, a ground sirloin burger. Okay. Which is why we put it on the menu. It's really good. You might just want a burger. It's like a woman last night said to me, I said, so what do you think? She goes, well, you know, you've got a really nice menu. She goes, but you know what? I just wanted a burger with fries. Perfect. You know, great. I don't know how we can really put our hands on it, but for us, anything goes. We're constantly asked this question, and I think this pretty much tells the tale. Are you enjoying it, you know? Or are you enjoying it more now, or... I'm going to tell you my pat answer is I've never had more fun.
Well, that's nice. That's a good answer, right?
Yeah, I've never had more fun.
We've been talking with Peter George and Tom Main of Tinker Street Restaurant. For more information on the restaurant, go to tinkerstreetindy.com or look for it on Facebook. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health, providing care to nearly 1 million outpatient visitors each year with the mission to advocate, care, teach, and serve at its hospital and inpatient facility and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. Well, it's definitely summer. It's hot and humid, and it's certainly been raining lately. So our backyard gardens should be doing great, right? Well, we certainly hope so. But Master Gardener Joe Ellenmeyer Sharp has noticed a couple of potential problems facing backyard gardeners in our area. So we sat down recently to find out why we should be keeping an eye on our tomatoes, peppers, basil, and other summertime favorites. So the last time we were talking about gardening, we were trying to hold ourselves back and not plant things too early. But
But now it seems like here we are in the middle of everything, so things are growing. But what else is there to do right now as far as a backyard gardener?
Well, the thing that we need to keep doing right now is successive planting of beans, green beans especially, and corn. We usually don't try to plant all of those at the same time because then all the beans and corn come on at the same time, where if we do them every week, 10 days, 2 weeks, then it sort of extends the harvest. It allows us to get those fresh beans and corn. And so that's always good. The other thing that I think is the hardest for people like me and other gardeners is to keep the beds weed-free. You know, even the vegetable bed and the flower beds. Weeds are really plant robbers. They steal the nutrients that the desirable plants need, the water and fertilizers and things like that. So this is the time to sort of stay on top of that because they're very prevalent right now.
So if I think of mulching, you know, might keep those weeds down and I maybe wouldn't have to weed so much, but that probably doesn't work completely, does it?
It doesn't work completely, but it definitely helps in a lot of different ways. It does reduce the weeds. It smothers them, keeps them from growing through. Also, it helps the soil retain moisture so that it stays sort of more evenly moist. It also keeps the soil, it moderates the soil temperature also, which can, you know, help protect the roots.
Now, we're talking about keeping the soil evenly moist. That kind of leads into a problem that maybe people are facing right now with some of their plants.
That's right. It's called blossom end rot.
It doesn't sound good.
No, it doesn't sound good, and it's not pretty. Okay. It's a big sort of like a black leather splotch at the end of your tomatoes or your peppers. And it's not at the stem end of the plant. It's at originally the flower end of the plant.
So the bottom side of the plant.
It's the bottom part of the plant where you get that. And it's a very leathery, thick spot that develops. I mean, it can be the whole base of the plant that can develop that. And it's caused by a lack of calcium. And there are products out there that can add calcium to the soil, which, you know, you can waste your money on.
Okay.
But the best thing is to just make sure that the soil is evenly moist. And it can be a bit of a challenge because, like, the last few days we've had a lot of rain. And so that's like all of a sudden there's like a lot of rain on the plants, which can contribute to blossom end rot. Or when there's not enough moisture, that can also contribute to the blossom end rot. And the plant absorbs the calcium from the soil by the water. So once the plant is watered, that's how it can take up the calcium. So it affects all, you know, plants in that family, tomatoes, peppers, eggplant. And so, you know, it's usually the first batch that a lot of times you'll get that because it's spring and the watering is uneven. We may have rain or no rain. And you can actually lop off the bad part of it and eat the good part.
So if I see like a pepper or a tomato with a big black splotch on the bottom, I think my first inclination would be like, oh no, you know, it's rotting or something like that, and to just throw it away. But it doesn't go all the way through the plant?
It doesn't. It stays at the base of the plant usually. You know, you might be able to get half of the tomato or half of the pepper. And a lot of times the plants will sort of outgrow it. So that later in the season, you may not have this plant, or you may have the plant kind of, you know, or you may not have the problem, or you may have it depending on your watering. But it's sort of like just getting on a schedule and making sure that everything is watered as it needs to be watered.
Now, it's not necessarily the amount of water, though. It's the calcium and the water is the way the plant gets that.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So are there other concerns, you know, right now with those kind of plants? You know, so all of our tomatoes and peppers should be out now, right?
Yes, those plants are warm season crops, so they should be out. Blossom end rot can also affect, excuse me, squashes and cucumbers. So it's not a disease, it's not an insect, it's a condition. And so there isn't really a treatment for it other than just making sure everything is adequately watered.
So is it consistent watering or not enough or too much or both?
It's really being inconsistent with the watering. And like I said, Mother Nature sometimes makes that a challenge for us, but it's being mindful of that And it really relates more to not watering when it's really dry.
Some other things, you know, I was thinking, you know, you were talking about the tomatoes and the peppers, and I was thinking about things that kind of go with tomatoes and peppers, you know, and so all the herbs are also out. You know, we talked about herbs earlier in the season, you know, maybe the ones we could put out early. But, of course, basil is always a favorite of mine, and, of course, we couldn't put that out then, and so I held off. But their basil, you know, is out now, right? Growing, and we should be paying attention to that too.
Yes, we should, because there's a relatively new disease on basil. It's called basil downy mildew, and it is a fungus-like disease. It can be airborne and waterborne. A lot of times, the plants we may buy at the garden center may have it. I know at some garden centers, basil is not on what we call the availability sheets, or the plants that are available from the growers, because they've had crop failures because this mildew has just decimated the basil crops.
Yeah, and where does that come from? I mean, do we grow basil in that much amount in Indiana?
We don't grow it that much in Indiana. A lot of garden centers here buy plants from Michigan or Ohio. And Illinois is a big basil-producing state for whatever reason.
Who knew, right?
Because when I was researching this issue, when we couldn't get basil, you know, at a garden center, then I thought, well, why can't we? And this is how I sort of learned all of this. But it can affect the home gardener also. So if you've been planting basil in the same space in your garden year after year after year, it's possible that that disease could be harbored in the soil. It may not live through our winters, but it could still be on leaves and things like that, debris that falls around, and it can be, like I said, transmitted by air or water. And so, you know, you just really need to be looking for that. First, the leaves turn yellow, and then there's a fuzzy substance that kind of develops on the underside of leaves, which gives it its name, that sort of downy.
Right, so moldy looking.
Yeah,
right?
It's moldy looking. It is. It can be grayish or sort of tannish. And like the blossom end rot, you can pick off the infested leaves and throw those away. I wouldn't put them in the compost pile, but, put them in the trash. And then you can eat the healthy leaves on a basil plant. And there really isn't anything that we can do to prevent that or to treat it other than not planting the crop in the same place year after year or in the same pot year after year without changing the soil and cleaning the pot. So, you know, it is a little bit of a problem for those of us who like pesto. People I know shun the idea of growing plants from seed, but basil is one of the easy ones to grow from seed. You know, one of those you just about have to say dirt and they sprout and grow. And it's
really?
One way
I didn't know that.
You know, have it all fresh all summer long because, you know, when we buy the plants in May and June and we plant them, we have to keep them from flowering. Sometimes you can eat those flowers, but I mean, you know, the idea is to not to let them flower, to keep them producing the leaves and everything. And so sometimes the plants get tired by the end of July. And so if you seeds maybe in late June, then, you know, the end of July, you'll have fresh basil too.
Okay. Now that's a good thing to think about because, you know, I don't think about starting basil from seed, honestly, you know, but I do want it all through the season, right, as long as I can get it. And I have noticed that plants maybe kind of slack off a little bit when it starts to get later in the summer.
Cilantro's the same way. And, you know, I'm sure that cilantro actually has two names. The leaf part of it is cilantro, but once it goes to seeds, it's called coriander. And they have two different purposes in our, you know, cuisine. But cilantro goes to seed really quickly. And so the idea, again, is to do that successive planting so that you have these plants coming on over a period of time, so every 3 weeks or so. So a few cilantro seeds, which are easy to grow from seed, and then you've got your fresh cilantro.
We think about, you know, basil and tomatoes. Are there some other things that we could be doing, you know, in the garden right now to kind of keep it going, or, you know, something I maybe haven't thought about that we could be putting in right now?
Probably the most important thing is to harvest the produce as it comes on. You know, especially early in the season, because when we harvest it, it's telling the plant, oh, you need to work harder, you need to produce more tomatoes, or you need more zucchini, or whatever. I can't imagine, but, you know, that's...
Yeah, no, maybe we don't need more zucchini, I don't know.
But, you know, harvesting it just encourages the plant to keep producing. And I think in early in the season, we all kind of think, well, I'll just wait a few more days, you know. And really,
you're trying to get that tomato as big and beautiful as possible.
Yeah, pick it because the next ones will be, you know, better and bigger. And the same, you know, like green beans, you don't want to leave those on for so long because the seeds get bigger in them, you know, and make them less edible. And we want to tell the plant, we want you to produce, so I'm picking these.
We've been talking tomatoes and peppers, basil, and more with local master gardener Joelle Meyer Sharp. For more on natural gardening in Indiana, follow her at HoosierGardener.com. So earlier on today's show, we were talking gardening. Well, now we've got some information on something you can do with the fruits and maybe even a few of the herbs and vegetables that you might be growing. Local bartender Eli Sanchez has become known for his creative cocktails made with shrubs. And no, these aren't the kind of shrubs that are in your yard. They are sweet tart vinegars that are made from fruits and even some vegetables, and he uses them in all sorts of creative cocktails. Now, Eli will be managing the bar at the soon-to-open Repeal Restaurant at 630 Virginia Avenue in Fletcher Place, and he's got plenty of information for us on shrubs, as well as what we can expect when Repeal opens July 13th. So tell me about the cocktail program at Repeal.
The cocktail program we have at Repeal is going to be very customer-driven, really want to be hospitality-driven. You know, if you have a question about the cocktails, we want you to feel free to ask about the questions. We don't want to be very smug, you know.
Well, yeah, I feel like I know that's what kind you mean, of. Right?
But we want, you know, lead you in the right direction. If, you know, if you come in asking for a moderate spirit, we want to ask you if, you know, you've tried, you know, if you're a gin fan, you had tried the Old Tom Ransom, you've tried Monkey 47, so on and so forth, you know, so we can really get people involved and really excited about what we're doing. So
now, so the restaurant is connected to a distillery, 1205. So how are you going to highlight those products?
Oh, so all of our base cocktails are all going to be 1205 spirits. So if you come in and order a Last Word or a Negroni or what have you, we're going to use our base spirits. Right now we just have the vodka and gin. We're waiting to get approvals on the whiskeys and wheat and a porter and a rye. So we're very excited.
All right. Is that exciting for you as a cocktail specialist? You know, is that exciting that you're going to be making this stuff right here?
Oh, for sure. And for me especially because I get a little input on what we use in some of the whiskeys and stuff. So, you know, I get a different profiles that we want to highlight. And it's, you know, it's fun to play with. You know, it's fun to actually be involved with the process. So
I guess so. So if there's something that you want to bring forward in a cocktail or something, that it could actually be distilled that way, right?
Oh, for sure. And we're also working on some cordials as well.
Tell me about those.
We're working on cordials. We're working on, right now, the one we're focusing on is a rhubarb cordial. We want a cordial that really brings out the rhubarb. We want something that you get that really sour rhubarb flavor instead of the sweet. A lot of them are sweet.
A lot of cordials are sweet, and, right? Kind of too much, very much so.
Very. And, you know, you got to offset it. And I feel like it with the sweetness, you kind of lose something with the flavor. So we're trying to tinker with something that's a little more flavor forward instead of sweetness.
So now tell me about the shrubs that you've been working with. I got kind of fascinated with shrubs last year, the old-fashioned drinking vinegars, mm-hmm. people call them. Tell me a little bit about how you make those and why they're a good ingredient for you.
Well, I love using shrubs in cocktails. I think everybody knows that by now.
you are the shrub guy, right?
That's what they try to say, yes. I love vinegar. I read about it. Actually, what really got me involved with shrubs is I was reading an article about how athletes were using pickle juice for cramps. And
I've heard that.
And, you know, it kind of hydrates the body, and it was really fascinating to me. And I started reading more cocktail books, and I started seeing shrub, and I was like, well, what is this? And I kind of just put the two and two together that it was they were both vinegar-based. And I got really fascinated because I saw a lot of recipes for shrub, and I was like, well, where do I get the shrub? And nobody really had made it, so easily available. So I made my own.
Now shrubs are fruit mixed with fruit of some sort, probably mm-hmm. mixed with sugar, and then you get the juice from that, right?
Yes. Basically, I like to say it like making a vinegar-based simple syrup, using the natural juices from the fruit to macerate with the sugar to make a nice, thick, rich syrup, and then add vinegar and let it sit. I like to let mine sit a little bit longer. I think most people, I like to let it mellow out a little bit. But, you know, shrubs have been around for a long time. I mean, if you really...
Colonial days, yeah, right?
I mean, even before that, if you ever read the Bible or are familiar with it, Ruth gave it to one of her co-workers. Vinegar, it was a vinegar-based drink. Roman soldiers used to use it on long marches.
So when we would read that, you know, you probably think, ooh, you know, but if you think about how you use it today, it doesn't sound awful, the whole idea of drinking vinegar. I mean, because you've, of course, mixed the sugar and the syrup with it, right?
Well, I think, you know, nowadays vinegar is used for, like, people use it as a cleaning product, and they use it as, you know, a pickling agent. And that's really only the common uses people think of vinegar instead of actually drinking it. It's supposed to bring actually body temperature down. They used to give it in colonial days for fevers. Now we use it in cocktails. Use it in a before dinner drink with a little soda water, aperitif, to stimulate appetite. And I love to use it in drinks.
So from there, then you can then take that into cocktails and play with those flavors.
Mm-hmm. It acts as both a sweetener and an acid. So you can use it as, you know, half part lemon juice or whatever it is you're going to use as citrus, and you can use that as well. And same with the sweetener. You can change out the sugars. It doesn't have to be the same sugar. You can use honey, sugar, molasses.
To change the flavor profile, sure, right?
To change the character of it. And also, it's not just fruit. A lot of people seem to think shrub all the time is just fruit. I've read tons of books. People use kale shrub. Cabbage, very
interesting.
Herbs.
Oh, I see now. I'm seeing where you're going with
that. Get that essence. You know, if you're trying to, can't get a specific spirit with a flavor, then you can use, you know, a lavender. You can do a lavender shrub, or you can do a kale. Whatever you want to put in vinegar, really, you can make a shrub out of.
You know, I like I said, I got into this last summer, and I didn't have much luck with cantaloupe. It didn't work out very well, but boy, peach made a great shrub. But I've got strawberries that I'm working on right now. So tell me what you've been doing.
We've been doing the rhubarb, a lot of rhubarb stuff. I love rhubarb. I grew up in Nebraska in the country, and we used a ton of rhubarb. So that's what I like to focus on. Strawberry is actually another one that's always readily available. I've had a guy tell me before, use what's readily available, not seek out something that's going to be hard to find and hard to come by. You want to use something that you're going to have all the time, and you can make a drink for somebody that, and then when they ask where you get it, you're like, oh, I come back because I have it all the time. So,
well, now tell me how you make it. So you start out with your fruit and mm-hmm. go from there.
I use a cold press method, which I get the fruit, quarter the fruit, take all the green off, especially the rhubarb. You got to take the leaves off because they can make you very sick. But yeah, you get the nice, very rich, flavorful, whatever you're putting in, peach. I think a lot of the juicier, sweeter fruits come out a little bit more prevalent in flavor, so you don't have to use as much. But like the herbs and stuff like that, you have to use a lot more than I think than it looks like you need. When you see that much, you're like, do I really need that much? But you really do, to get that flavor. You really want to get that, because you're going to strain a lot of it as well. So
that's true. So you strain it, or now how? What kind of proportion do you use for the syrup and the vinegar?
I actually use I like to use weight instead of actual measuring out. I like to use weight, so I use equal parts and weight for each. So equal parts vinegar, sugar, and fruit, or whatever it is that you're putting with the for the shrub.
So then once you you know, add the vinegar to it, and then you get this sweet tart sort of thing going, then how do you go about creating a cocktail with that?
How I first started out with it, well, I just started making a bunch of shrubs, and I was like, well, what do I do with all these? And I actually, the Flavor Bible came in to really help me out with that. You know, I didn't was looking at flavors, what pairs well with what, and then I kind of had an idea of what I wanted to do. Now I do it opposite. I see a cocktail or old cocktail, and I'm like, oh, that a shrub would go great with that. Now, what flavors do you want to pull from that? So then you can go, or a spirit you see that you, like a gin that's very juniper heavy that you know it's going to go well with a lavender or something like that, you can, you know, make a shrub specifically for that now. So that's the process now for me, instead of just guessing to what would go well, you know.
So what are some of the spirits that go well with some of the shrubs that you've made?
Some of the shrubs that we made, the strawberry rhubarb gin, goes well. The I mean, you can use vodka with a lot of them because it takes the flavor of whatever it is you're mixing. I actually like to do a little rum, a nice little rum scotch cocktail that I like to do every now and then with the apricot shrub.
Oh, apricot? Rum. Apricot, oh, honey. Yeah, that sounds good.
Honey shrub's really, really good. Almost like a swizzle. Comes out really, really well. You can really pair with anything that, you know, because a lot of spirits have a lot of fruit notes to it, especially like whiskey. You get the, you know, peachy, pear, spicy, cherry wood, you know, all that stuff. So you can, whatever you think goes well with that. I mean, it's really up to whatever you like, especially if you're making it at home.
We've been talking with Eli Sanchez, bar manager at Repeal Restaurant, which opens for dinner July 13th in Fletcher Place. To keep up with what's coming up at Repeal and at its adjacent distillery, 1205, be sure to look for them on Facebook. Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health. With its 315-bed hospital and inpatient facilities and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis, eskenazihealth.edu. The craft beer scene in Indianapolis just keeps on growing, and the city will gain another brewery when Sanctuary Brewing Company opens in September at 140 South College Avenue. And this brewery will be donating at least 5% of its profits to animal sanctuaries, so you can see where the name comes from. The brewery will also be animal-friendly and will have an outdoor space where dogs and their owners can play. To get a few details about the new brewery, I stopped by to talk with Cynthia Rausch, Head of Marketing and Communications for Sanctuary, and Aaron Kerner, who's Director of Brewing Operations. So tell me just a little bit about the idea for Sanctuary and how it all kind of came about.
Okay, so Dave and Rand have brewery tours of Indianapolis, and they love the craft beer industry. Dave was a home brewer for a long time, and Dave and his wife also have given to animal sanctuaries a lot, you know, the $20, $30 donations, and they started thinking about beer and how much they love that and how much they like animals, and thought if they combined it, they might be able to give bigger checks and make more of a difference. And so 5% of all of our overall profits, that's the minimum, but we know at least 5% of our overall profits are going to go to animal sanctuaries.
Now, tell me what kind of beer you're going to be brewing.
We're going to be brewing a lot of different styles. How our system's set up is we'll have about 5 to 7 house beers to start with, a 3-barrel subset. So it's a 10-barrel system with 3 3-barrel fermenters and brights as well. So we can do series batches, split that up to make a few different ones. And then tons of different one-offs, always rotating out. We'll brew it a keg at a time. So
what kind of one-offs are you interested in making? What kind of interesting things could we look forward to?
So different ones that we've been experimenting with now. I did a chocolate banana Rogan beer.
Okay, that sounds interesting.
Yeah. I've done a mango rye, English mild. Basically, kind of I looked through what I like to drink and then expanded on it a little bit.
Now tell me a little bit, like we were talking about, your background in brewing locally.
Okay, so yeah, I started at Oak and Barrel volunteering, did that for a while, and then brewed there for a few years. Then I moved out to Oregon and worked at a few breweries, two out there, Fearless Brewing Company for a little bit, and then Bunsen Brewer. Got that going. I also worked at a winery, Buddha Cat Winery, out there as well. Did that for a little while, and I was kind of ready for another move. Not necessarily looking to move back to Indy, but I was looking around, and I saw an ad posted for this place, and it just seemed too good to pass up. So it helped that I already know the city and have a history here. So, yeah, I came back in January, late January, and did an interview, and I was working the next week.
What's it like so far just working to get a brewery up and running? Is that pretty cool here?
Yeah. I've been kind of on the ground floor of a few little projects, different things like that. So I've seen kind of some of the beginnings and stuff, how it's formed. And there's a million breweries opening up around here. A lot of good friends have recently opened up their own breweries. I mean, just quick example from around the corner, you have St. Joseph's. Alan Simons is over there. I worked with him at Oak and Barrel. And Dan Kriswicki has always been a good friend. Him and Skip Duvall have done Chili Water. If you're willing to put in the work, it's not that bad.
So we're not oversaturated with breweries yet, right?
I absolutely don't think so. You know, everybody's still kind of doing their own thing and has their unique drives and purposes. And, you know, we're still smaller than we used to be pre-prohibition. So there's a lot of room to grow. I don't think we're going to be stealing business from anybody else. And
I'm kind of looking forward to seeing where Indianapolis's craft beer culture goes. You know, what styles that we, you know, seem to become known for, or what kind of things that our brewers are interested in. So this is sort of an interesting concept, you know, a brewery that's, you know, created specifically in order to give back. So tell me a little bit more about that.
What I can tell you so far is that the way that we think we want to have it set up is that we'll have 12 that we give to with that 5%. So each month will be dedicated to one of those 12.
We've also discussed doing specific beers for specific causes. So if there's some lion at some shelter that has a broken leg or something like that, dedicating one specific special beer to that cause to raise money. So doing a little split stuff like that here and there.
Now, what kind of schedule do you see coming on, you know, as far as when things are starting to come in and then you can start brewing? Because it looks like construction is really starting to pick up, right?
Hopefully. Our tentative, fingers crossed, is September. Everybody's been saying Labor Day, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was just in September sometime. But so fingers crossed for September.
Now, once you get things in, how long does it take you to get you know, beers up and ready?
So we have been brewing since February, just the keg at a time stuff. But it'll be a few weeks to get everything in place and running and do some trials and whatnot. We'll be getting our system in August 5th. So that will give us basically the whole month to get kind of ready and stuff and get a few ones going in operation for opening and then thereafter.
So what do you expect to have when you first start?
So we'll have an IPA, a pale ale, a German honey weiss, a Irish red, and a cream ale.
All right. Do you have any favorites?
The fan favorite so far is the honey weiss, but I think mine is still the IPA.
Which one do you like?
The honey vase.
Describe that, you know, in case people aren't familiar with what that is.
So it's kind of a traditional German wheat beer, but it's brewed with honey malt as well. So we don't actually use honey, but it gives a similar sweetness as honey. So now,
what's going to be happening with the building? People, it's probably a building I'm guessing that people drive right by and they really haven't noticed it, you know, much. So what can you expect on the outside? You know, outdoor stuff and, you know, things people would be able to notice?
Absolutely. We have a lot planned. So first and foremost, in about 2 weeks, 10 days about, we'll have banners up. We have a big banner coming that'll say coming soon, and three more that we'll have to put around fences, everywhere like that. Wall construction is happening. Then on this side toward Georgia, we're going to have that wall painted, a mural of with our logo and animals and things to represent who we are. On the side facing College, we're expected to have the terrace with the porch also, a smaller one. We'll have seating outside with the terrace that'll have hops growing up the terrace, actually. And then there'll be parking, and then in the parking sort of off to the side area will have a small grassy area for dogs to play, people to play cornhole, outdoor games. I know we're going to have giant Jenga. Yeah, we'll have a food truck that it's so we're offering other food trucks to come in and park here.
Oh, so you'll have food trucks that they'll have food available.
Yes. Right, yes. Okay. But we're also going to have our own food trailer so that even if the food trucks can't come, middle of winter, things like that, you'll be able to get food here. But we're also allowing you to deliver in. Milano Inn is right across the way if you want them to deliver or just pick it up and bring it in. So, yeah, you can definitely eat here. We just won't be producing food in the brewery.
Well, that sounds kind of fun. You know, call up and you have a pizza brought over or something, right?
Absolutely. We've been talking with Cynthia Rausch and Aaron Kerner of Sanctuary Brewing Company, which will be opening in September at 140 South College Avenue in Indianapolis. To keep up with the progress at Sanctuary, check out sanctuary.beer or look for it on Facebook. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. Thank you for tuning into this show this week, and thanks also to our guests, Peter George and Tom Main, owners of Tinker Street Restaurant, Joella Meyer Sharp of TheHoosierGardener.com, Eli Sanchez of Repeal Restaurant, and Cynthia Rausch and Aaron Kerner of Sanctuary Brewing Company. And thanks also to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio.
Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.